Welcome to In the News, I'm Chris, and today I'll be reading from the AARP magazine. This is Jeff Watts. How you doing? First article is entitled, Brooke Shields, What to Know. There was a frenzy span in the early 80s when Brooke Shields was arguably the most famous, talked about, most gushed over female in the universe. A Kardashian times 10. She was an ivory soap baby at 11 months and continued to model for the agency of Eileen Ford, who created a children's division just to bring on Shields. After a small part in a horror movie, she was cast at age 11 in her second film as a child prostitute in Louis Malle's Pretty Baby, where her nude scene sparked outrage. At 14, she became the youngest model to nab the cover of Vogue, starred shipwrecked in the tantalizing blockbuster The Blue Lagoon, and twisted her body into a pretzel in those sassy, controversial Calvin Klein jean ads. The 80s look, and just before her 16th birthday, embodied unbridled teen passion. She was just being projected into some other stratosphere, recalls her childhood friend and actress Laura Linney in the illuminating 2023 Pretty Baby Brooke Shields. She represented a femininity at the time. There was a sense that she was the woman of the future. According to Brooke's mom, Terry, a former model and makeup artist, the stratosphere was always her daughter's fate. She looked at me and said, "This baby is going to be a star." Brooke says today with a wistful smile, "This baby was going to be her savior." We're sitting in one of Brooke's favorite cafes, just blocks from the Greenwich Village home she shares with her husband, Chris Henchy, and her two daughters, Rowan, 20, and Greer, 17. Sipping alternately from a steaming mug of bone broth and a mysterious frothy green concoction, Brooke is analyzing her life and career like a therapist. In fact, she just got off the phone with one. She tells me he's in the mood for a self-reflective interview. At 58, it's all still there, those fluffy eyebrows, the pillowy lips, that beautiful cascading mane of chestnut-colored hair, other than a little crinkle around the eyes when she emphasizes an important point, Brooke remains hauntingly as we remember her for those glossy magazine covers and 50-foot movie screens. But she is not that sexy woman child today. Surprisingly, Brooke insists that she never was. "The world was fake to me," she said. "It wasn't my real life. It wasn't me." Brooke first began dismantling that image in 1983 when she detached superstardom to attend Princeton University. "But the post-graduation years were a dark period," she says. "A fickle Hollywood have forgotten all about the women of the future." That bleak period coincided with her moving on from her overprotective alcohol manager mom, who divorced Brooke's father, Frank, when Brooke was 5 months old. And she capped off with a sexual assault by a powerful film executive, a secret she revealed publicly for the first time in 2023. Picking herself from all that trauma, Brooke pivoted. In 1994, she honed the thespian chops on Broadway, singing and hoofing in Greece and later Chicago and Cabaret, winning over critics. Her 1996 guest appearance on Friends as Joey Tribbiani's stalker fan drew raves, and she gravitated to a new niche, comedy. Her sitcom, Suddenly Susan, allowed Brooke to be her funny, dorky, and real self, and America liked that. She received two Golden Globe nods in 1997, a People's Choice Award. "It wasn't like she became funny," says Susan co-star Judd Nelson in the Pretty Baby documentary. "No, that was always there. We just didn't get to see it." Some of her highlights: in 1966, modeling debut at 11 months is shot by the legendary photographer Francisco Scavulli. 1977, cast in Pretty Baby at age 11, she's dubbed the next Lyota. 1980 came Blue Lagoon. Also in the 80s, the Calvin Klein jeans. In 1987, she graduated from Princeton with honors and a degree in romance languages. 1996, Suddenly Susan debuts. 2003, daughter Roan is born after infertility struggles, followed to severe postpartum. Stars in Netflix rom-com Mother of the Bride. And also in 24, Experts expects to launch Beginning is now a digital platform for beauty and wellness advice for women over 40. She found love marrying tennis great Andre Agassi in 1997. The union lasted 2 years, but she's not regretful. I think we get into different relationships for different reasons. And if you do believe in fate, real life Hollywood meet cutes, she met writer-producer directly Henchy, Spin City entourage, soon after when her dog wandered off studio lot and Henchy returned him. They married in 2001. "He makes me laugh," she says. "I think I always knew that I needed a solid and normal. He's very good dad. He goes to the basketball games, volleyball games." On cue, Brooke whips out her iPhone to proudly show photos. "They're very old soul children," she says. "Personality-wise, Rowan's like a golden retriever puppy, and Greer's like a cat. At home, she's down-to-earth mother. While Chris cooks, she likes to relax, watching TV, doing puzzles, needle-pointing. But she also stays busy outside the home, particularly with her nest about to be empty. She's starring in a rom-com, Mother of the Bride, streaming on Netflix in May. Working on a new book about aging and launching a platform for women over 40. There are so many moving pieces," Brooke says, taking a deep breath. Here's her side of the story. What was it like to be so famous as a tween and teen? It only became clear to me how famous I was when we went out. If we went to Studio 54 or the Cannes Film Festival, there would be hordes of people and paparazzi screaming my name and sometimes rocking the car. And I'm like, this is nuts. It was like facing a firing squad. My mom would say, "You've got to get out of the car first. They're not here to see me." Strangers feel close to you, and it can be overwhelming. Suddenly, you're responsible for every fan's experience. But because I have zero shared experience with that person, it could be overwhelming and create a huge, shocking sense of isolation, like, oh my God, I really so far away from everybody. But you seem so mature dealing with all that. I was a thoughtful kid. I really did see things deeper, and I didn't want to lose my cool on camera. There was one interview where the woman asked me the same question 3 times. I finally said to her, "Excuse me, ma'am, but I don't think you want my answer because I keep giving it to you and you keep asking me the same question, waiting for a different answer. But I have no other answer because this is my truth. I'm a champion compartmentalizer. It was the only way to stay buoyant. Whenever a director would say cut, I'd go separate and often just leave, go to my regular school or my dad's or be in a completely different world. College was a real wake-up call. Yes, because early on, this one professor was looking at me saying, 'Shields, what is your hypothesis on this?' And I'm like, 'I don't know.' That was such a revelation because no one had ever asked for my opinion. They didn't need me to have an opinion. In Hollywood, they just needed me to be what they wanted me to be. But the professor got it. He saw it. After I graduated, I assumed I would do another movie. I was like, I'm smart. They're going to love a smart actress. But when I returned, it was like night and day. I was starting at zero. I was starting at negative 10. Up until then, my film career really had been about acting. But after I finished college, I could not find roles. And the book deal was being sold. It was hard for the industry to understand what I was. Was I a model, an actress? What was I? It was a very difficult period for me. Then came the sexual assault by a Hollywood executive. How did you cope with that? I'm not naming the person because then it will be about him. I want it to be on my terms. It's a universal problem. It doesn't matter who's doing it, it's still happening. I was shocked, then surprised, then fearful, then disassociated, going like, okay, what can I do to get out of here? What needs to happen so I can leave? But the most crushing and embarrassing thing was a part of me that felt validated. My career was not in a great place, and it's so sick, but my brain was telling me, oh, you're cool, because he picked me at that moment. It's mind-blowing. You feel such shame. It would be easier if the person had jumped out of the woods and had a hood over his face. With the help of Andre Agassi, you broke up with your mother as a manager. One friend said in Pretty Baby that it was going from one controlling relationship to the other. It was a transition that I needed. I wasn't strong enough to separate from my mom on my own. I kept falling back in. With Andre, it always felt good to feel smaller than another because he was so famous and number one in the world. Everywhere we went, he had tons of bodyguards. I could sit back because it wasn't my world. He was the first one out of the car when we arrived at events. It was a real kind of respite. After the assault, I was mad and I said, I cannot live without performing. I can't. This is not fair. You can't take this away from me. I needed to find ways to do it. I studied and took serious acting classes, and I replaced my mom with an agent. My mom kept calling it a divorce, and I was like, oh, mom, I'm still your daughter. But if I'm going to do this, I have to do this on my own. I'll make my own mistakes. But that meant I didn't need her. And then, who was she if I didn't need her? Emptiness to my mother was like death. In the 90s came Friends, Broadway gigs, Suddenly Susan, and a comedian was born. Friends was big. It was such a validation of my instincts because I was told not to do laughs. And then they screamed across the room, put it back in, Shields. In that moment, I was like, I have this up here. And all those years doing Bob Hope specials, I knew better. Not a lot about things, but about that. And that's how I got Suddenly Susan. And on stage, it all clicked in a way that was the best use of me. I had such a feeling of accomplishment every single night. Yeah, I did that. And I did it again, and I found a new laugh. I did it again, and they're standing up for me. I looked at the audience faces and they loved it because I was performing at the top of my game. Whatever happened to the rules-obsessed child you were? Yes, all my life I've been conscientious one asking, what are the rules? But I've learned to ask forgiveness rather than permission. My husband tells me at the time, I'm like, you know what? That's a new channel for me and I like it. I recently turned down a project and it was hard for me because I don't back out of things, but it was giving me anxiety. There were other things I needed to do. Get a foot operation, write a book, get my company off the ground. At a certain point, I asked myself, why do you want to put yourself through this? I don't want to do it myself anymore. I felt relief saying no. How does your parenting compare with your own upbringing? From the time my girls were kids, I spoke to them as human beings and made my best effort to switch it back around. What do you think about that, or how does that make you feel? They never felt judged. My dad was tough because he didn't acknowledge anything. I did. We would take family photos, and he turned to me, "No, don't pose." And I'd be like, "I'm not." And then my mom would be, "Stand up straight, do this, no, no, do that, smile, don't do this." It was always like that. And I wanted to be a good girl. And if I wasn't a good girl, that what would that mean? The worst thing she could say was, "I'm disappointed." And I'm like, "Oh my God, I've done it now." That, I think, was a function of her alcoholism. There was an edge to it. But I'm in a safe zone for whatever the girls feel, think, do, even if it's wrong. The empty nest looms, right? When we left Rowan at college a couple years ago, our whole world shuddered. I didn't expect that. And now Greer's departure this fall, you can already feel in the household the anticipation of it shattering our souls. We're all dealing with it in different ways. Greer's trying to find ways to hate us so that's easier to leave. And Rowan just spent 4 months in Florence. And you find yourself not knowing who you are if you're not predominantly a mom. You don't realize how much of your life is occupied with. Get them to school. Get them into this. And then all of a sudden, silence. Nothing. Who am I now? As you inch towards 60, what are your thoughts on aging in front of the camera? You have to change the narrative. It's a front to people. Brooke Shields gets older. You can't grow up. You cannot age. It's disappointing to them that I don't have the same face I had when I was 16. But it's been so liberating for me not to worry about it. The pressure of being skinny is so exhausting. I like food. I like tequila. I have a job to do. I know that I'm going to look better if I'm a little fitter, but I also look younger when I have extra weight. What was Catherine Duval said? At a certain age, you have to choose between your face and your ass. How is beginning is now going. It's going. We'll be creating platform for women over 40 so they can age with confidence. We don't have one foot in the grave, people. Founding a company is not for the weak. I've never experienced anything like it. It's hard to ask for money, especially from men who have already left their wives who are my age and are on the younger models. But I'm getting a kick out of wowing them with how much I know. And it's very empowering because I'm not doing it in a snotty way. I'm just owning the power that I learned that I do have. Your AARP. AARP backs Rolling Stones' summer tour. Concerts highlight a season of excitement. The news that AARP would be sponsoring the Rolling Stones 24 American tour struck more than a few outside as unusual when it was announced last November. But it was clear to both sides that it was an opportunity too good to miss. When they approached us as a tour sponsor, it was a no-brainer. The band's legendary status, longevity, and timeless appeal across generations makes this fun for everyone, whether it's their first Stones concert or their 50th, says Martha Brudeau, AARP's Chief Communications and Marketing Officer. As the tour's late April kickoff approaches, the feeling that the collaboration is a great fit continues to build. On the heels of AARP's 65th anniversary, it's a unique opportunity to celebrate the Rolling Stones' more than 60 years of recording and performing. Brudeau says AARP members agreed, buying out a huge batch of tickets offered exclusively to them late last year. AARP will join the Rolling Stones at all 17 U.S. shows on the North American tour, culminating at Santa Clara on July 17th. AARP will have a spot inside the stadium concourse at each show, as well as being featured on the big screen before the band plays. Concertgoers will find AARP's tour exhibit nestled with merch stands where, among other things, they can take a humble brag photo in front of a green screen of tour bandmates. One thing that makes the AARP sponsorship different is the connection between music and brain health, a topic explored deeply in the December 23, January 24 issue of this magazine. Music, for example, is one of the few established tools for helping people with Alzheimer's, a disease that affects 6.7 million Americans. The band's lineup has changed through the years, but it's still anchored by the duo of Mick Jagger, 80, and Keith Richards, 80, and longtime group guitarist Ronnie Wood, 76. AARP will bring you more excitement this summer. Can't make the Stones tour? AARP will hosting several free concerts. AARP sponsorship of the Association of Pickleball Players continues through Labor Day. Join us at the movies this summer. AARP's Movie for Grownups will host free screenings of feel-good classics and fun rom-coms chosen for grown-up film lovers. Visit aarp.org/free movies to find online and in-person screenings near you. Real People, Senior Center Tales. Retirees to the rescue. For Kathy Barbado, Michelle King, and Galen Sullivan, a midday break turned into a dramatic face-off. Michelle King, we spend a lot of time together at the Senior Center in our Connecticut town, sometimes inside, sometimes outside, taking a smoke break. Kathy, and I'm a nurse, I should know better. Galen, one day last May, we were out front smoking with three men from the center. Across the street, we saw a girl walking with a guy telling him, "Leave me alone, I just want to go home." Kathy, then he put his hands on her and blocked her way. At first, I didn't believe what I was seeing. Michelle, she started crying for help. She was like 18, 19 years old. Galen, the guy was young too, maybe in his early 20s. We weren't scared of him. We were like, "No, you ain't getting near this girl." For me, it was a motherly instinct. Michelle, I was molested as a young teenager, and I was older, hung onto a biker bar. I was not going to let this happen in front of me. Kathy, I grew up in a violent home. When you live through something like that, it touches you even more. Galen, I went to the middle of the street and said to the girl, "Get over here," and she came running. This poor girl had bruises. She would have high flower planters in front of our center, and I struck her in the back of them and stood next to her. And then these two confronted the guy, Kathy. Michelle was right in his face. "Michelle," I kept saying, "I dare you to hit me. It'll be the last time you ever raise your hand." Graylin, Kathy is in an electric wheelchair, but that doesn't stop her. He started going towards Michelle. He was trying to get past her to get to the girl. So I took my chair and I ran right into him twice. Michelle, one of the gentlemen we were with had a cane, and he got up and waved it at the guy. None of the men wanted to talk to the press. Galen, together, we kept this young guy away from the girl until the police came and they arrested him. Michelle, it was a Friday, so chances were good he was in jail for the weekend. And we know he was charged with assault and disorderly contact. It was a case of domestic violence. Kathy, the Senior Center held a dinner in our honor, and the police gave us all six citations for bravery. Galen, even though we are considered seniors, we're still strong, and we're going to stay strong for as long as we can. We kind of don't take crap from anyone. Kathy Barbado, 72, is a retired nurse. Michelle is a retired waitress, and Galen, a retired nurse's aide. They all live in Meriden, Connecticut. That tat has to go. Paula Perman is a medical doctor, gives patients a fresh start. Perman at work in Homeboy Industries Free Clinic. She's a retired emergency medicine physician, Paula Perman. She's 70 years old, and she lives in L.A. Removing a tattoo is painful. Like bacon grease or a hot rubber band snapping up against your skin. I usually need 8 to 10 sessions to fully remove the ink. A session doesn't last that long, but it can be 10 seconds of pure agony. I remember using a numbing cream beforehand, but patients often declined it. It's almost like they think they deserve the pain as a price for the bad decisions they made in their past. Getting a gang tattoo is your entree into that life. And when you're leaving that life behind, having a tattoo removed helps to close the door on that chapter of your life. It can be transformation and liberating. So even after the most painful removal sessions, almost every person says thank you to me. I got into this by happenstance. Back in 2000, when I was still working as a physician, I met a young doctor who told me about Homeboy Industries. That's an LA-based nonprofit that helps formerly gang-affiliated, incarcerated, or trafficked men and women to become productive members of society. It provides job training in the Homeboy Bakery and Homegirl Cafe, and at Electronics Recycling and Silkscreen and Embroidery Social Enterprises. When I heard about Homeboy's tattoo removal program, I immediately volunteered to help. In 2015, that's the year I retired full-time from the emergency medical practice. I took over as the volunteer medical director for the clinic. The Yastuva, that's enough in Spanish, tattoo removal clinic, it's a busy place. We remove tattoos from as many as 40 people a day. Everything from swastikas to swear words to gang symbols to the names of former partners. 40 people a day. I have worked on people as young as 13, believe it or not, and old as 60 years old. I once took care of a woman who had been sexually trafficked. Her trafficker had his initials tattooed on her. I can't tell you how important getting those initials removed to her from her. And I was honored I was able to do that for her. That's an amazing story. It can be tough for the clients, but I love it. I sometimes arrive feeling grumpy or irritated, usually because of the traffic on the freeway. But that all changes when I walk through the door. I'll hear someone say, Dr. P's in the house, and then I happily get back to work. There's a wonderful vibe here. I meet people from rival gangs who before, believe it or not, might have killed each other and now are kneading bread next to each other over in the bakery. They remind me that no human being is beyond hope. With help, anyone who truly wants to change can turn their lives around. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I'm Jeff Watson. I've been reading from the AARP magazine, April and May of 2024. So long until next time.